Chapter 13. Interface. Players play games through an interface.
That's true.
Lens 53, the lens of control. This lens has uses beyond just examining your interface.
Oh,
well, good thing you put it in the interface chapter and not somewhere else, since meaningful control is essential for immersive interactivity. To use this lens, ask yourself these questions. So, chapter about control? Let's see.
He's brought it up yet. Yeah. Not specifically, you know.
Technology isn't a part of control.
Well, technology is a much broader subject than control.
Yeah.
I'm willing to believe that control is a subset of technology,
through an interface, interest curves, indirect
control. Ah.
All right. Well, when players use the interface, does it do what it is expected? And if not, why not? Intuitive interfaces give a feeling of control. Is your interface easy to master or hard to master? Do your players feel they have a strong influence over the outcome of the game? And if not, how can you change that? Feeling powerful equals feeling in control. Do your players feel powerful? And can you make them feel more powerful somehow?
So it's kind of interesting that you bring up a feeling of power in the interface. Generally, my experience with negative interfaces hasn't made me feel unpowerful. It's just kind of brought me out of the game and been like, oh, now I have to figure out what I'm actually supposed to click on here. Now, maybe I'm thinking about interface in a slightly different way than he is. Because the example that's in my mind about bad interface is Civilization VI. And it's actually got better since it was released. But when it was released, you know, most programs establish a single mode of closing a dialogue. Right? So there's always going to be a cancel or a close button at the bottom of the dialogue. Or there's always going to be a little red X at the top right or something like that. And Civilization VI does this. Generally speaking, there's always a button at the bottom to close it. And sometimes that bottom actually does an action and leads you on to the next thing, and sometimes it just closes the window. But the text on the button tells you which it's going to do, so that's fine. But the diplomacy screen isn't like that. The diplomacy screen has a number of modes where there is a button at the bottom, but there are also a number of modes where there's not a button at the bottom.
Oh no.
And if there is a button at the bottom, it just doesn't close the window.
Oh no! What does it do?
Well, it brings up some dialogue option or... And so if you want to get out of that particular diplomacy screen, you have to go up to the top right and click the little red X.
So it's like top right red X is always get me out of here, and then like at the bottom is continue this interaction as would normally be expected or something.
Well, kind of, except that the reason I want to close this diplomacy dialogue is because I'm done with it. So the natural continuation is to close it and move on with the next step in the game.
Sure.
And so the fact that there isn't a button at the bottom that naturally leads on to the next thing in the game is the exception.
Yeah.
And there are a few things like, or there were at least a handful of things like this in Civilization VI, where you would get to a dialogue and you'd say, okay, I want to move on with the game, let me just click the obvious button. And the obvious button doesn't do what you want, so you have to go find the little red X. And because you usually don't have to click the little red X, that feels out of place. And so... it doesn't make me feel any less powerful, because the feeling of power from the game, which isn't really why I'm playing it anyway, but the feeling of power from the game comes from the gameplay and the interface. These interface elements feel pretty separate from gameplay.
Sure.
And so the best thing they can do is to just kind of stay in the background and not get noticed. And when you notice them, it's, hey, Mr. Designer, I see you back there being bad at interface design. And then you move on.
Sure.
And I don't think that has anything to do with the feeling of power, but it isn't what you want as a designer either.
Well, I think this is getting a bit into, we're talking about mostly about the virtual interface, which is what he's named it. So you've got the physical interface, which is like the actual screen and the actual controller that you have, or keyboard or mouse or whatever. And then you have the virtual interface, which is the in-game interface between the controls that you have and world simulation that's happening in the game. So Lens 54 is the lens of physical interface.
Aha.
Somehow the player has a physical interaction with your game. Copying existing physical interfaces is an easy trap to fall into. Use this lens to be sure that your physical interface is well suited to your game by asking these questions. What does the player pick up and touch? Can this be made more pleasing? How does this map to the actions in the game world? Can this mapping be more direct? If you can't create a custom physical interface, what metaphor are you using when you map the inputs to the game world? How does the physical interface look under the lens of the toy? How does the player see, hear, and touch the world of the game? Is there a way to include a physical output device that will make the world become more real in the player's imagination? The world of video games occasionally goes through dry spells where designers feel it is not feasible to create custom physical interfaces, but the marketplace thrives on experimentation and novelty, and suddenly specially crafted physical interfaces like Dance Dance Revolution met, the Guitar Hero Guitar, and the Wiimote appear, bringing new life to old gameplay by giving players a new way to interact with old game mechanics.
An interesting thing about all those examples he brought up is none of them are popular anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
They all had, like...
We've gone back to the handheld controller.
Yeah, we had, like, a decade of popularity there. And I think it's when the, like, half-generation younger than us were in their teens, maybe? And now that our generation is the dominant game-buying generation, again,
right.
We've gone back to keyboard and mouse and handheld controllers.
Well, sure, because it's less work. You don't have to get up and move around. All of those are large motor things, right? The examples that he's given.
Yes.
Yeah, Why do large motor actions when you can do small motor actions?
Right. But it's interesting to look at how the different interfaces affect different game players and things like that.
Yeah. Well, and also we've gone further in the direction of large motor interface as well in terms of VR.
That's true.
So, I mean, large motor stuff is still popular. In fact, it's probably more popular than ever. It's just become more refined and generalized.
I want to see Guitar Hero VR where you literally just stand there and air guitar.
Yeah.
With your headset.
Does it not have? Does it not exist yet?
I've never heard of it.
It should. It must. We must make it exist. How could that not exist already?
I don't know, man. VR games are expensive to develop.
Are they?
Yep.
I don't think that's true.
It's definitely true.
No. Well, they don't have to be.
That might be true.
Because you have to... Okay, so here's the thing about VR games. You have to limit your graphical complexity. It has to be at least half as graphically complex as another game that would normally run on the computer. And then half again because it has to run at 60 frames a second instead of 30. So it has to be, at max, a quarter as complex as any other game that you would make visually. And if graphical design and development is the primary cost driving factor, which it seems like it is, then they can't be as expensive to develop.
I think one of the things, too, is right now, and this is some speculation, but I'm pretty sure a lot of the medium-sized to big studios have kind of an engine team and then a game-making
team. Oh, sure.
They probably work together pretty closely, but VR engines are still really bad, so there aren't any good VR engines for a company to just hand to its game-making team and say, hey guys, we built you a VR engine, go make us a game in this.
Right, and probably the VR engines that do exist are platform-dependent. You've got the Vive VR engine and the Steam VR engine, or are those the same guys? Anyway, and the Oculus VR engine and the Sony VR engine. And so if you want to develop a game, now suddenly you have to develop it for multiple different engines. It's not even different platforms. It's like, you can't even use the same engine on multiple platforms.
Right.
Well, that's silly.
Another thing about physical interfaces is and I don't recall if you said it in this lens, but it can be useful to think about how your physical interface is accessible to different players. So most games I play are with a keyboard and mouse, and that's pretty accessible to anybody.
Sure.
Although when my kids first started playing games, a full-size mouse was pretty unwieldy for them.
Sure.
And this weekend, I set up my Steam controllers so that they could work outside of Steam and plug them into Super Mario World and got that all set up, and my sons were playing it, and my younger son had a real trouble actually holding the Steam controller in a way that made it easy for him to play the game.
Oh.
Because it's so much bigger than his hands.
Right.
And so I don't think that's necessarily a fault in the design of the Steam controller, because the designers probably had a target demographic in mind, and it's probably not tiny five-year-olds.
Right.
But that's just an example of how choices you make about the interface for your game, specifically the physical interface for your game, can and do affect the people who are able to play your game.
Yeah. Can you buy child-sized controllers?
I don't know. I mean, there are a bunch of, like, Logitech makes a bunch of, like, really simple controllers that remind you more of the old, like, original PlayStation controllers than anything that's out today.
Sure, it's got a D-pad and four buttons or whatever.
And I think some of them even have a left stick or something like that, but they're a lot smaller than things that are kind of based around the Xbox form factor, which is what the Steam controller is kind of going for.
Right.
think actually PlayStation controllers are still a lot smaller than Xbox and Steam controller.
Well, that might be one reason for its continuing success.
It might be.
You can always hold a small controller in your giant hands.
As far as I can tell, one of the primary reasons for PlayStation success is that they own exclusive rights to Naughty Dog stuff. And Naughty Dog is doing things that not really anybody else is doing.
Well, that also could be a factor. Maybe it also is a factor of their virtual interface, which is Lens 55.
Aha!
Designing virtual interfaces can be very tricky. Done poorly, they become a wall between the player and the game world. Done well, they amplify the power and control a player has in the game world. Ask these questions to make sure that your virtual interface is enhancing player experience as much as possible. What information does a player need to receive that isn't obvious just by looking at the game world? When does the player need this information? Do they need it all the time, or only occasionally, or only at the end of a level? How can this information be delivered to the player in a way that won't interfere with the player's interaction with the game world? Are there elements in the game world that are easier to interact with using a virtual interface, like a pop-up menu, for instance, than they are to interact with directly? What kind of virtual interface is best suited to my physical interface? Pop-up menus, for example, are a poor match for a gamepad controller. I don't know if that's true, because if you've got a gamepad controller, you can always just have one button mapped to close the pop-up menu.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure what he means by pop-up menu. Maybe he means like something where you have to go right-click. Maybe he means context menu.
Oh, I see. Yeah. But you can always just have a button that maps to bring up the menu.
Yes. I'm not saying that this is impossible. I'm just saying maybe we can imagine where he's coming from.
Yeah, all right, fine. So that he's got a little graph over here, which you listeners can't see, but I'm not really convinced that you exist at this point, so that's fine. And he's got the virtual interface as kind of mediating between the physical input and output and the world. So you've got this virtual interface sitting there. And we've talked about the virtual interface a bit. So, I mean, kind of, that's mostly what we've been talking about when we talk about interface.
Yep.
But I feel like there's probably another virtual thing that sits between, or like in the middle of the physical interface and the player, which is the perceived world or something like that. And that seems like that's as much a part of the game. Like, the virtual interface creates this virtual world in the perception of the player. They don't, you know, you don't ever perceive the world of the game directly. Maybe that's where a theme sits or something? I don't know. But there's something that mirrors across the physical input and physical output from the world and the virtual interface.
Yeah, but I think that exists in the mind of the player. He's just calling the player a thing.
Yeah.
Remember, experience exists in the mind of the player.
That's
true. He's even already covered that.
Yeah. But things like reflexes and motor skills and habits and things like that are something that exists in the player, but as a result of the game interacting with them.
Right.
So, like, when you first start a game that requires really twitchy reflexes, you're not very good at it. But you can train yourself so that you become better at it, so that you can play the game better.
Sure.
And so there's this wetware interface of some kind, right, that exists not in your hands, like, able to touch the keyboard or able to hold the controller, but in the way that you're thinking about the interface, and, you know, whether you've got Y flipped on your mouse control or whatever.
Right.
And it seems like that should be as much a part of the interface as anything else, because if you can accommodate different habits, like WASD controls, for example, are really common. And if you can accommodate that, then it seems like you should. It isn't really a part of your virtual interface, because it doesn't have to do with, like, mediating the physical input and, like, giving the player information. I guess it is kind of part of the virtual interface, but it has more to do with how the player is thinking about interfacing with your game, as opposed to how the game is thinking about interfacing with the player.
Yeah, I remember back in the day, before WASD was popular, we would play Jedi Knight using the numpad for our directional control.
Right, because there's more button density there.
Yeah.
I still think that's probably a good idea.
Well, it depends a little bit on how many buttons you need, because there's more buttons right there on the numpad, but if you need, like, a, what, 11th button or something, well, not 11, 10 numbers.
At least, yeah.
Six other things, six or seven. But if you get up to where you need, like, 20 buttons, Now there's no other button. Not even close.
What? There's page up and page down?
No, that's not close.
That's that whole cluster that's so right far there. Away. It's got so a far away. It's even got a convenient physical divider there so that you can tell exactly which button you're pressing without hunting around for the little nipple on the F and the G key.
Yeah. But that's far away because that's on your pinky or ring finger, and your pinky or ring finger are shorter. So you have a more limited reach. Where when you play WASD, your index and middle fingers, which are your longest fingers, can get to the F keys or all the way over to like 5 or T or something like that. So you have a lot more reach at WASD.
So you use your pinky as an anchor.
Right.
Which is how it naturally works.
Right.
Oh, okay. Makes sense. You have the whole keyboard there for access.
Yeah.
I really love how SpaceChem did its virtual interface, physical interface mapping, where it's got the little bar at the bottom with all the controls, and they're laid out in a nice, organized way so that, you know, rotate right and rotate left or right next to each other and stuff. And then the shortcuts for those buttons, for those operations, are mapped directly onto the keyboard. So it's not like, oh, well, R is rotate. No, no, it's just like W or something is rotate left, and Q is rotate right, or something like that.
Right, everything is right in a row, just like it is.
As it is on the virtual interface on the screen.
Yep.
And so then you don't have to remember where things are. You can just be looking at the screen the whole time, and your fingers can do all the interface stuff. It's just, it's so perfect. And I really wish that games would do more of that, where instead of mapping, like, to WASD or something. I mean, WASD makes sense because it's easy for mapping to direction arrows. But it would be really nice if they had some way of, like, here's this physical thing that you're trying to interact with. And instead of, like, having arrows for going up, right, down, left, or whatever, they just mapped it right onto the keyboard. And, like, we're just going to take this grid and we're going to put it right on the keyboard. You've got a 3x3 grid. It's the numpad. Go crazy, you know?
Right.
And then and if you want to make the grid bigger, you could have the grid broken up into sections and, like, take the whole... You could have a 4x4 probably pretty easily on your keyboard using the numbers at the top and then all the way down to the bottom row. That's 4. Yep. And so then you could have a 4x4 grid for controlling stuff, and it's totally directly physical on the keyboard. And, like, okay, yeah, maybe someone's got a Dvorak keyboard. Okay, or maybe someone's got one of those crazy sideways, what is it, or what do they call it?
The ones with the big hump in the middle?
Yeah, where they're divided.
Ergonomic.
Ergonomic keyboard, yeah. And so, it, like, maybe it wouldn't work so well for those, but you can always remap it.
Well, you can't always remap it, and that's actually the point I was going to make, is that there's a lot of power in being able to remap things. And so there are a lot of games that, for one reason or another, imagine that they would have a very simple physical interface.
Sure.
And World of Warcraft is one of them, but they didn't, especially at release. When you got up to a higher level at the beginning of the game, you had more than a dozen abilities, and you had to move around in the world, and you had to be able to jump. So you've got your core, you know, moving around buttons,
sure.
And then you've also got at least a dozen specialized buttons that you need to hit. And the game only gave you 10 things, and they were the numbers from 0 to 10. Maybe it gave you 12, you could go all the way to equal.
Yeah.
But then the game actually had a lot of things in it where it was good to have multiple versions of a single ability up there, and they started giving you items, and those items needed to be activated, and so people had to write mods to put stuff on the F keys, and also because you don't want to have to press 8 or 9 or equals, because that's really, even your index finger can't reach over there.
Right.
You've got to move your whole hand to do that. And they've refined the game somewhat, and there are fewer buttons to push, and they've incorporated a lot of ideas from mods, and there are more ways to put buttons on the keyboard. But I remember my brother, who was really into player versus player in that game, completely remapped everything he did. I think he even moved over from WASD to give himself more buttons on the left side of his hand.
Yeah, there you go.
And that way he never had to move his hand.
Sure.
And I think he had something about spacebar being easier to get to also. But because of that, he was able to be a lot better at player versus player. Not than I was, because that's not impressive, but he was able to do quite well.
Sure.
And the power that was available to him to remap all of his keys allowed him to build something that worked well for him. And then that also translates well into accessibility, where if you have somebody who doesn't have an index finger, you can let them remap their keys and they can work around their absent index finger.
Sure.
But there are a number of games that just don't have control remapping these days, and
seems so odd
on mouse and keyboard games. I just don't understand why that would be.
Yeah. Yeah, if you've got a game controller or a gamepad or something, you're targeting a console, okay, it makes sense. But then if you're going to do a PC release, you really got to just have a control map. Like, it's just one layer of abstraction. It's not complicated by any means. It's not going to slow down your program at all.
Yeah. I think some of it has to do with they literally never developed that kind of menu when they were writing the engine, because they didn't need it.
Sure.
And then the engine guys are all busy porting, because they're the ones who actually have work to do to get the port done. And you ask them, hey, could you make us a menu so that we can remap things? And they're like, sure, do you want us to be another week late?
And the answer needs to be yes, but I guess it's not.
Right.
Well, that brings us to the lens of transparency. The ideal interface becomes invisible to the player, letting the player's imagination be completely immersed in the game world. To ensure invisibility, ask yourself these questions. What are the player's desires? Does the interface let the player do what they want? Is the interface simple enough, with practice, that players will be able to use it without thinking? And I have a note on this point that the players will always be able to use it without thinking, with enough practice.
Sure.
The point is to have as little practice as possible required.
Right. Will the players be able to intuit its use?
Right. Yeah, how quickly will they be able to use it without thinking? Because it's also never going to be so simple that they can immediately use it without thinking.
Right. Well, I don't know. The Witness gets pretty close to that.
But only because it's building on the convention of WAS.
That's true. It really just doesn't even have a virtual interface.
Well, the game itself is kind of playing with the idea of interface.
That's true.
And control mapping? It doesn't really do control mapping. It does output mapping. Like, it's different, it's conveying different ways of communicating to you that it wants you to draw a line somewhere.
Right. But I feel like the way he does that without, you know, you never get an overlay that comes up and shows you, like, oh, you could have seen it this way. You don't have a...
Right, it never takes you out.
A pattern searcher.
Yeah.
Right, there's no virtual interface to the game, per se, at all, except you can press escape to get to the menu and leave.
Yeah.
Like, there's no hit points display. There's no targeting reticle. There's nothing shown to you that isn't a representation of the game world.
Right.
And so he's experimenting with communication and seeing, like, how much common context can we form with the player just through a representation of the game world.
Yeah. Do new players find the interface intuitive? And if not, can it be made more intuitive somehow? Would allowing players to customize the controls help or hurt? Does the interface work well in all situations, or are there cases, near a corner, going very fast, etc., where it behaves in ways that will confuse the player? Can players continue to use the interface well in stressful situations, or do they start fumbling with the controls or missing crucial information? If so, how can this be improved? Does something confuse players about the interface? On which of the six interface arrows is it happening? Apparently he's got six interface arrows.
Bunch of arrows.
There's the arrows on his diagram between the world, the virtual interface, the physical input, and the physical output.
Yep.
He doesn't have an arrow drawn directly from physical input to physical output, which is, I guess... No, there really should be an arrow there, too. He's got arrows everywhere else. Ah, well. This interface, a parody from the webcomic Penny Arcade, is probably not transparent. And so this is the Starfire Saga demo controls, which, yeah, is just a joy of nonsense.
Left D-pad,
examine blue chests. Right D-pad, choke pixie. Just up D-pad, cycle through mandibles. Down D-pad, unclose hyper menu.
Oh boy.
Which, really, that's the only button that you need for your interface.
Certainly.
just keep hyper menuing.
Yeah.
and then your directional controls are controls inside the hyper menu. And your buttons are selections in the hypermenu. You just need one button, then. One button, one D-pad, and the unclose hypermenu button.
Seems reasonable.
The loop of interaction. Information flows in a loop from player to game to player to game, round and round. It is almost like this flow pushes a water wheel that generates experience when it spins. Wait, why am I reading this? This isn't a lens.
I don't know, man.
We're skipping all this stuff. The lens of feedback. The feedback a player gets from the game is, this is lens 57, is many things. Judgment, reward, instruction, encouragement, and challenge. Use this lens to be sure that your feedback loop is creating the experience that you want by asking these questions at every moment in your game. What do players need to know at this moment? What do players want to know at this moment? What do your players want to... What do you want your players to feel at this moment, and how can you give feedback that creates that feeling? What do players want to feel at this moment, and is there an opportunity for them to create a situation where they will feel that? I feel like if someone wants to feel something, they're just going to go right ahead and feel that, whether you want them to or not.
I don't know if that's true.
All right. What is the player's goal at this moment? What feedback will help them toward that goal? Using this lens takes some effort, since feedback in a game is continuous but needs to be different in different situations. It takes a lot of mental effort to use this lens at every moment of your game, but it is what time well spent because it will help guarantee that the game is clear, challenging, and rewarding.
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty meaningful.
Yeah. The feedback is really the time aspect of the game.
Right.
And if he talks about the game needing a story, well, feedback is the story that the game is telling at the most granular level.
Right.
And the story is the feedback that the game gives the player at the large level.
Yes.
Lens 58, the lens of juiciness!
Oh boy.
To call an interface juicy might seem kind of silly, although it is very common to hear an interface with very little feedback described as dry. Juicy interfaces are fun the moment you pick them up. To maximize juiciness, ask yourself these questions. Is my interface giving the player continuous feedback for their actions, and if not, why not? Is second-order motion created by actions of the player? Is this motion powerful and interesting? Juicy systems reward the player many ways at once. When I give the player a reward, how many ways am I simultaneously rewarding them, and can I find more ways? Consult your list of known pleasures, if necessary. The motion that cleaning base shows. Let's see. I'm trying to...
I was going to ask, by second order motion, is he referring to acceleration?
The Swiffer is fun. So apparently it has to do with, let's see, problems. Sweeping is boring. Sweeping is repetitive, it uses the same motion over and over, and requires you to focus your attention on something with no surprises. Because if you don't monitor the little pile of dust, it goes everywhere, but if you do monitor it, it doesn't do anything interesting. So how does the Swiffer meet this challenge? This might be the biggest selling point of the Swiffer.
I have a feeling this dude really likes the Swiffer.
I guess so. Lens 15, the lens of the toy. Is it fun to play with? Why? The base of the Swiffer, where the cloth is attached to the stick, is a special sort of hinge. It's called a universal joint, by the way. So that when you rotate your wrist even slightly, the base of the cloth holds rotates dramatically. A little motion from my wrist makes cleaning mechanism moves easily, fluidly, and powerfully, getting into exactly the position you want it to be in with the minimum of effort. Using it kind of feels like running a magic race car around the floor of your house.
Whoa.
The motion that the cleaning base shows is second-order motion, that is, motion that is derived from an action of the player. When a system shows a lot of second-order motion that a player can easily control, it gives the player a lot of power and rewards, and we say that it is a juicy system, like a ripe peach, with just a little bit of interaction that gives a continuous flow of delicious reward. Juiciness is often overlooked as an important quality in a game. To avoid overlooking it, use the lens of juiciness. So I feel like what he's saying is that you should have tight controls, perhaps? Or, because juiciness is, I feel like, is something different from the tightness of control that he's talking about with the Swiffer.
Right, where the actual physical actions that you take as a player have precisely the effect that you want in the game.
Yeah.
Fairly intuitively, right, where the magnitude of the changes made in the game world against the magnitude of the changes made with your finger are intuitively derived and help you feel powerful or, you know, good at whatever you're doing in the game.
Right.
Or maybe this dude really just likes Swiffers.
Well, yeah. He certainly thinks that Swiffers are juicy, and I wouldn't describe them that way.
No. It turns out it's still sweeping.
It is sweeping. But I feel like the idea of juiciness does have, like, there's something in it where you, if you think of the opposite of something that's dry, right, where you, like, you click a button and it just goes clack, and like, okay, well, no, you click a button and it just goes, like, doop or something, and then you could have a different interface where the button goes clack, where it has, like, a very strong the mechanical sound when you push a button. So it seems like that's more juicy than just like going beep.
Right. So that's actually something that games also played with, I think maybe 15 years ago. So originally in computers, clicking a button didn't do anything. And it wasn't just games. Even Windows did this.
Sure.
When you clicked a button, it didn't make any sound. There was no feedback at all. Just your window disappeared. Or it did what it was supposed to do, or whatever.
Right.
And that was basically true in games. When you clicked on a menu item, you just went to the next item in the menu, or, you know, went to the next menu screen, and that was it.
Yeah.
Nothing fancy happened. And then I feel like it was around the turn of the century, everybody's like, hey, wouldn't people like it better if our buttons made some noise? And so they put some noise on them.
Right.
And people did like it better. So they said, what if our buttons made lots of noise? And so then you wound up with things like, I think it was, I don't remember if it was the first Jedi Knight or the third, but one of the Jedi Knight games, whenever you clicked on a menu item, it would make this like whole drawn out lightsaber sound. And it took a long time, and I don't remember if it was blocking, because another problem with a lot of this in the early days was that the sound wound up being blocking, so you had to wait for the sound to finish.
Yeah, and before you could have another sound play.
Right. And that wasn't always the case, but you wound up with this really long sound effect, and Windows ME was a big offender here, where by default everything you did made a sound, and all of the sounds were just a little bit longer than you really wanted them.
Right.
And you couldn't use it in an office environment or something like that, because then it's like, oh, did that guy click a button? I wonder what he's doing.
Yeah.
Because it made such a noise that it couldn't really be ignored, even by bystanders. And so there's kind of been in the time since then, there's been a lot of refinement towards, making sure sounds aren't blocking and identifying exactly how much sound and how long a sound someone is willing to put up with before they're like, I'm bored, can I please just have my thing now?
Right.
And even like the Windows startup sounds are an example of this. You know, the Windows XP startup sound took, I want to say, a second and a half to play. And that doesn't sound like a long time, but in comparison, the Windows 10 startup sound takes like a third of a second to play. It's much faster.
Yeah.
But it still gets the point across. You still know, oh, my computer is ready now.
Right.
And but it's not long enough to interrupt conversations, which the Windows XP startup sound was.
Right. And you could imagine, Nintendo does this to a certain degree, where when you open a chest in Legend of Zelda, right, it's got this long animation where you're opening the chest, and it's got this long musical cue that builds up, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right? Like, for 5 or 6 seconds, like, it goes on and on and on. And you're like, at a certain point, it becomes obnoxious, because when you first do it, it's like, whoa, I'm opening this chest, what's it gonna be? A rupee, wow, I only have 2 of those, now I have 3, this is amazing! But then, like, after you've done this 100 times, you're like, yes, I know, it's gonna be like a gold rupee, I'm gonna get 100 coins, but I've got 20,000 of them, and, like, I don't care, I just want to go back to playing my game.
Yeah.
Why can't I skip this opening chest thing?
Yeah. That's one of the only unskippable things in Overwatch, is the loot box animation.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
you can skip actually getting the stuff from the loot box.
You just can't skip opening it.
Opening the loot box.
They have to just shower you in juiciness.
Yes.
Which is the other thing that I feel like he's missing here, is that you don't want everything to be juicy. Like, there are a lot of things in games that I want to just be dry. Like, moving a chess piece from one square to another, just give me a dry interaction there. I just need to go click. I just need to go, or like a nice deep thump to make it feel like I've got this really heavy, nice, solid stone chess piece or something. Like, just something really, really terse.
Right.
Like, I don't want it to have particle effects and, like, bloom lighting and, like, when I move a chess piece, it's keep the juice out of that.
Right. This actually goes back pretty well to his peach analogy.
Yeah.
Where imagine if all food ran all over your face every time you took a bite out, right, like peaches do.
Right. Yeah, I don't want to eat a peach in my car on the way to work. I don't want to, like, take a peach with me in my pocket, because it's going to get bruised and then it's going to get all over everything.
Right.
Peaches are lovely in the right context, but I don't want them all the time.
I could barely handle peaches in the first place, much less on as everything.
Right. You have to take a special kind of attention to enjoy a peach properly, or it's just going to get all over you.
Yeah.
The missing question here seems to be, is juiciness appropriate for the interaction that this player, that the player wants right now?
Right. Because you can actually even kind of excuse some juiciness on starting up Windows, right? Because especially back in the day, it took like 5 minutes to boot up your computer.
Yeah, you're going to go get a sandwich.
Right. Give me a sound that's long enough for me to hear it. That's fine. Where you can't excuse juiciness is in turning off your computer. And that sound was just as long.
Right. Right. I don't want to interact with this thing anymore.
Right.
But wait! Oh, goodbye! We'll see you later! No, stop. I will see you later, but I just told you I don't want to interact with you anymore.
Right.
Long goodbyes.
Yep.
Not necessary. Lens 58. I think that's the last lens in... lens 59. Oh, it's probably... Oh, yeah, because this interface, the last lens is going to be like the lens of the interface or something. Lens 59, the lens of channels and dimensions. Choosing how to map game information to channels and dimensions is the heart of designing your game interface. Use this lens to make sure that you do it thoughtfully and well. Ask yourself these questions. What data need to travel to and from the player? Which data are most important? What channels do I have available to transmit this data? Which channels are most appropriate for which data and why? Which dimensions are available on the different channels, and how should I use those dimensions?
So, this reminds me a little bit of a thing from work, actually, where there's a compliance form that gets filled out, or it gets generated automatically by a computer. And the compliance form is telling you by how much, specifically by what percentage, have you passed some threshold for compliance. And it has this graph associated with it, and the graph shows you your margins on a bunch of different things, right? So it doesn't really matter what they are, but there's a bunch of different categories in which you can succeed or where you can exceed or fall short of some threshold, and it shows you that by being a little bar out to the left or right.
Sure.
So I looked at one the other day, and these are all normalized, so whatever your biggest one is, it's always going to be all the way over to the right.
Okay.
And I looked at one the other day, and I was like, wow, that's a really big bar out to the right. I didn't... My compliance margin was 0.8%. I had this great big bar going halfway across the page to show my excessive compliance on this one axis.
Right.
It's like, no, that should be a tiny little nub, because I don't want to imagine that I'm like 100% over on this thing.
Yeah.
I'm barely squeaking by.
Wow.
And so that's an example of poorly mapping your data to a dimension.
Yeah. I feel like the lens of channels and dimensions is a really, really good lens.
For all kinds of design.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't really matter what you're trying to represent, or whether you're making a game, or whether you're making boring state-mandated compliance software.
Right. Or just trying to communicate with someone. Like,
right.
Okay, what ways do I have to communicate, and what kind of information is best communicated in what ways? Like, people call me up and tell me dates and times and stuff. It's like, I don't want to... Like, dates and times, email them to me. So then I have it written down. So then I can just copy and paste it over into my calendar. So then I can, like, you know, all that stuff is... Don't tell me on the phone, like... But over the phone is really useful for stuff where you need a lot of interaction with the person, where you need to cue against their feelings on a topic, or against their... if they have, like, ideas that might need to have a lot of iteration or something like that. Like, that's where you want to call someone up. You don't want to call someone up to tell them a fixed set of data. You send that by email. And then if you want to make a presentation, you don't call someone up on the phone to, like, tell them where on the floor plan something is. You send them a picture. Or, you know, you draw a picture, you sketch something, right? Like, you redline it. So there's all these applications for using channels and the appropriate channels for the appropriate kind of information. And
yeah.
I feel like a lot of people... just don't think about this at all in general, let alone in game design.
Right.
So he's got a bunch of tips on how to use modes. And then he's got the lens of modes, lens 60. An interface of any complexity is going to require modes. To make sure your modes make the player feel powerful and in control, do not confuse or overwhelm them and ask yourself these questions. What modes do I need in my game and why? Can any modes be collapsed or combined? Are there any modes that are overlapping, and if so, can I put them on different input channels? When the game changes modes, how does the player know? And can the game communicate the mode change in more than one way? What is an interface mode? Simply put, is the change in one of the mapping arrows in our interface diagram. For example, if pressing the button B changes the functionality of the gamepad so that instead it makes your avatar run around, it makes your avatar use a water hose instead. This is a mode change.
So that also seems really important.
Yeah, that was something that I occasionally found frustrating in Kerbal Space Program, where they had a mode flip where you could go from rotational control to translational control or something like that.
Yeah, and docking mode versus piloting mode. And then there's rover mode.
Right, but it wasn't easy enough to switch between them, and the mapping wasn't actually very good in most cases outside the regular mode.
Yeah.
And so it wound up being sort of a hurdle where I think you could actually map one of the modes to just the right-hand side of your keyboard.
Oh.
And I just always used that.
Yeah.
I never actually bothered switching modes. I just went over and used IJKL or something instead of WASD.
Right. Yeah, and there was no display on the screen to tell you what mode you were in.
I think there was like this little set of buttons at the bottom, and whichever mode you were in was lit up. But something that Kerbal Space Program did a really poor job of was actually communicating to you what button does what. Because it's a fairly complicated game in terms of what you could do.
Yeah.
But it's also fairly simple in terms of what is most obvious. So if all you want to do is what's most obvious, like it's just WASD and Z and control or something, and then you're done.
Yeah.
But if you want to do some of the more complicated things that the game allows you to do, you wind up needing a lot more control. And the game did not communicate that elegantly during gameplay, right? Like, you could go to the key mapping screen back at the Space Center and see what all your buttons do.
Remap everything if you wanted.
Right. But that's the last resort in terms of communicating control in your game.
Yeah.
It's one of the worst ways to do it. Because then you have to say, well, I imagine I know what I want to do, and I think I have a name for it. Let me look through this list of names and see if my name is in it.
Yeah.
And it's not, because you were thinking like...
Well, they don't have a search function in the control mapping either.
Yeah.
Which is be really, really nice, especially in a game as complicated as Kerbal Space Program. The other thing is that their defaults weren't very good. Like, when you went to the launch pad, the camera was in such a position that when you pressed forward and backward, your spaceship would go north and south. And it was forward and backward from the view. But you could move the view around, and it wouldn't change the way that your mapping was on your spaceship. Like, if you turned to go the direction you wanted, then press forward, you would still be going north. You had to actually rotate your spaceship around it to get in the direction that you wanted to go. And it seems like it would be really nice if they had just automatically remapped that, because, like, really, do we have to fly this like a real rocket? You could, I suppose. But it'd be nice if they had a mode to do that. And then, like, when you're driving a rover, it still just used the spacecraft controls, and there wasn't an easy way. I don't think there was a rover control mode, was there?
I don't remember. I don't think there was either.
Yeah.
And
so it seems like it would be great if they could just have a rover control mode where when you're on a rover, or whenever wheels touch the ground, it just automatically switches to rover control mode.
Right.
Like, it wouldn't be difficult.
That actually wound up being a problem in some cases, too, because holding down W made your wheels spin. But if you had any torque, it also made your... thing try to flip over forwards.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you wound up flipping your rover over forwards all the time because you were literally trying to do that all the time.
Right. Yeah, it's just mode changes. Absolutely. And yeah, what modes do I need in my game? Kerbal Space Program needed a rover mode, and it didn't have one.
I could probably add one.
Could you? Could you add it to the keyboard mapping screen? Could you add a search function to keyboard mapping screen?
I could probably do that, too.
Wow.
That'd be harder.
You're quite a guy. So how can people get in touch with you if they want you to add mods to Kerbal Space Program?
Well, I don't actually have time to do any of that right now.
No? You got to set up a Patreon, and people can just...
They can pay me, but I still won't have enough time.
Well, if they pay you enough, then you can quit your job. You can go part-time at your job and just write mods for Kerbal Space Program all day.
That's true.
Does that sound like awesome to you?
It would be fun.
All right. Well, there you go. Just set up a Patreon. Set up the baseline limit at when I reach $4,000 a month, I will go part-time and start doing Kerbal Space Program mods 2 days a week or whatever.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome. I'd love to see that.
Until then, I'm going to do absolutely nothing with your money.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just going to put it in my pocket.
Yes, exactly. No, no. You will, in the meantime, be thinking about it.
Ah, yes.
I'll be thinking about modding. Maybe, well, you could probably do, like, you know, different tiers. The lowest level is just like, okay, well, when I reach $1,000 a month, I'll come back on the forums and, like, spend an hour a day talking to people on the forums about modding. I mean, I'm sure you could spare that, you know, or half hour a day, 15 minutes a day, whatever, yeah, whatever level you're comfortable at.
That's right.
And then, you know, at a higher level, it could be like, okay, well, then I'll take, like, half of my Saturday and devote it to doing modding stuff. And then, you know, $8,000 a month, you can be like, I'll quit my job and just do modding full time.
Well, dear audience, if this is something that you want, let us know in the comments.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Leave a comment, and I'm sure that the spam filter will block it, and then we'll have to go in the spam thing and, like, fish it out.
A few months from now, when we check the spam filter, your comment will